Tuesday, April 13th, and I'm interviewing Christina Witt of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
So you know that I'm tape recording our conversation, correct?
Yes, I do know.
Great, thank you. So just to begin a bit about your experience here at NIEHS, what is your background, your education and training?
My education is BS in zoology and MS in genetics, and then some work toward my PhD, but I never completed that. That was in human genetics.
Mm-hmm.
So primarily a fairly strong genetics background.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that involved also genetic toxicology work before actually the term was formally coined.
Mm-hmm. What was it called then?
It was just genetics, but the toxicology of it was woven in to coursework and in projects.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that.
And then when did you come to the NIEHS?
I actually first arrived here the end of 1985, and I came on on an interagency agreement with Oak Ridge Associated Universities.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know if somebody picks their head in. If they want the room for anything, we'll have to relocate. And I probably, I don't recall offhand, but I was probably almost 10 years in that position on the interagency agreement through Oak Ridge. They're a DOE
mm-hmm.
contractor.
So had you had been at Oak Ridge prior?
No, I had
not.
How does that work? Because there was currently a position open that was an interagency agreement funded position with Mike Shelby at NIEHS, and at that time Mike Shelby was integral to the genetic toxicology testing program
mm-hmm.
here that was being developed. This was kind of in the early stages of the development of the massive NIEHS NTP, National Toxicology Program,
mm-hmm.
Genetic Tox Database.
Okay. And what was the nature of the interagency program?
The program was, there was at Oak Ridge Associated Universities and Oak Ridge National Labs. These are two distinctly different organizations, but located within very close proximity to each other. Both of those units had genetics groups, genetic toxicology groups. At Oak Ridge, it was more reproductive genetic toxicology.
Mm-hmm.
They did multi-generational studies looking at transmissible genetic damage or damage that somehow impacted reproduction. At Oak Ridge Associated Universities, they were looking more at the traditional in vivo mouse genetic toxicology endpoints, which were chromosomal damage endpoints. They were sister chromatids change and chromosomal aberrations. And then they got into micronucleus testing, which became a substitute for doing chromosomal aberration testing, which was arduous, time-consuming, difficult on the score.
Mm-hmm.
But the micronucleus test became a substitute for that and was a lot quicker
mm-hmm.
and consequently less expensive to do. So they did those three endpoints, and that's how I got involved, because I had a genetic background.
Mm-hmm.
I did primarily clinical genetics work before I got here, but the last 2 years or so prior to my coming here, I became involved in genetic toxicology work out at the University of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing chromosomal aberration studies and sister chromatin exchange studies and micronucleus studies,
mm-hmm.
and so coming with that recent background made it easy for me to move into that open position
mm-hmm.
here within the program.
And then how did your career develop at NIEHS?
As I said, I spent approximately 10 years. I have to actually go back and calculate, but it was around 10 years that I spent in that interagency position. And when I came to the NIEHS, I obviously needed to quickly broaden my background because the NTP was involved in more than chromosomal aberration type assays. They were looking at other endpoints. They were looking at gene mutation endpoints in mammalian cell cultures as well as in bacterial cell cultures. There was a little bit of work in unscheduled DNA synthesis for a while. That was an assay that was done for just a very brief time. Okay, we're back online. So the involvement of my career. So I really had to become educated in all different aspects of genetic toxicology, not just as they pertain to the testing program developed or under development by the NTP, but the broad efforts in genetic toxicology, because one of my primary responsibilities when I came to NIEHS was to prepare the genetic toxicology overviews that go into the NTP technical reports. NTP does two-year bioassays. Are you familiar with those? Have you published what are called blue books?
Yeah, I'm familiar with them, but I'm always happy to be reminded.
Actually, I can show you some. Okay. We have an entire library of every single report that's ever been issued by NCI, which began where the program began, and then NTP here at the NIEHS now has responsibility for that effort, and that is the cancer bioassay, the 2-year studies in mice and rats, both sexes, of chemicals of interest, nominated either by government folks or an outside source for testing. So anyway, those reports contain an overview of what is known of the genetic toxicology of that particular chemical, either through testing done at other laboratories around the world or through NTP tests. And it is still my responsibility to provide a literature review of the genetic toxicology data on the chemical, as well as to prepare the data tables and summaries of the tests done under the auspices of the NTP on that chemical. So I spent probably 6 months originally learning everything I could about genetic toxicology and then applying it both as it primarily in the beginning with the reports, and then as I became more and more involved in the program and using the knowledge I had acquired to help in discussions among the folks that were involved in the various genetic toxicology testing efforts for the NTP, in determining what tests were most useful to the program, and with the mission of the NTP being primarily cancer, which of those tests best help the program in its efforts to determine whether or not a chemical presented a risk of carcinogenicity, and which tests helped in understanding how that chemical might be promoting its effects. And I actually, after the interagency agreement was terminated about 10 years after I first came here, I then became a contractor to the NIEHS and was employed by a contract company here in Research Triangle Park that has a number of contracts with NIEHS, both pathology type contracts for the NTP related to the cancer bioassay work, as well as genetic toxicology contracts. And just last July, I became an NIEHS employee. And so now I am even more integral to the genetic toxicology testing efforts of NIEHS and the NTP. I must say, in addition to the standard cancer bioassay work that's done in the genetic toxicology work relating to that effort, there's also has been for years a reproductive toxicology testing effort, and Bob Chapin is the person who was in charge of that for years and during most of the time that I was here. And probably Bob left maybe 3 years ago or so, and Dr. Jack Bishop, who is over here on East Campus, right over there, took over responsibility for that. He is a geneticist, a research geneticist, and his expertise for years, probably for most of the time that he's been at NIEHS, and he came about the same time I did, 1985, has been in reproductive genetic toxicology. So he was involved with a lot of the contract work that was done through Oak Ridge National Labs. If you recall, I said there were two institutes in Oak Ridge. One was the Oak Ridge Associated Universities. And they did more of the traditional short-term tests looking at chromosome damage as it related primarily to cancer. And Oak Ridge National Labs did a lot of the heritable sorts of work, and Jack was involved in that for a long time and has been involved in some other efforts recently, more molecular sort of approaches to looking at the types of genetic damage that may be induced in germ cells.
Okay.
And so I can't remember where I was going with that. Now
let me
that
ask you a question about what you just said.
Okay.
I imagine that approaches to genetic toxicology testing have changed some during...
They've evolved.
Could you describe that evolution to me?
One of the papers I suggested you become familiar with was the Tennant et al. paper.
Right, the 87
right,
paper in science.
Right, the 87 paper in science, and there were actually a couple subsequent papers that built on that effort that were evaluations of the massive NTP database that was accumulated over, say, a 10-year period. When Tennant et al. Published that 87 paper, I think the beginning of that database was probably 82, 83, okay. something like that. So it was maybe a five-year effort. Some of the tests may have gone back a little bit before that, but NIEHS is not one of the older institutes. I think we were, I was here at the time, but I think it was, what, 76, 77, something like that, when the NIEHS was established.
69.
Was it 69?
69. But it didn't have a building until much later.
Okay. So I'm just thinking back to the very early chemicals in the database, the earliest I recall having seen a date attached to anything was around 82, 83, and obviously chemicals must have been tested prior to that, but that was probably then before we had electronic databases, and they're probably still hard copy files in somebody's archive somewhere with those early testing efforts, because actually our first massive salmonella testing paper compilation of maybe 200 or 300 chemicals was published in 1983, so obviously those chemicals must have been tested in the years prior to that. So those are probably still hard copy files somewhere and never been in the electronic database. But early on, there was a fervent desire, and it's expressed in the both the Tennant et al. Paper, and I think one by Shelby as first author, perhaps in 86, or it may have been later in the 80s, that the goal had been and the thought had been, surely there must be a short-term test, which is what we refer to anything less than this two-year cancer bioassay, a short-term test using fewer animals, costing less money, and requiring far less time than everything that's involved in a two-year cancer bioassay. It's not just that 2 years, but it's the preliminary studies, dose-setting studies and whatnot leading up to that 2 year. And then the several years after that for data analysis and evaluation. So we're talking about a 6-7 year effort typically to get out one of those cancer bioassays. So there must be a shorter term test that could give us some very, very clear clues as to whether or not a chemical will be found to be positive in a cancer bioassay. So the mouse lymphoma testing, that's an assay. The salmonella bacterial mutagenicity assay, the short-term chromosomal aberration tests and sister chromatin exchange tests in cultured Chinese hamster ovary cells. Those were four tests that were done on a number of chemicals in the NTP program. And for several years, every single chemical that was of interest in the NTP and that looked like a reasonable candidate for testing in any or all of those assays. So another one was the Drosophila sex-linked recessive lethal assay and reciprocal translocation assay. Okay, so those were both germ cell assays in fruit flies. Mm-hmm. Many chemicals, in some cases hundreds of chemicals, particularly in the salmonella assay, were entered into those assays and tested, and data was collected, and a massive database mm-hmm. was developed. And then the first attempts to correlate the data from those assays and from the cancer bioassays was made. And that first publication was the Tin and Out, 87. And what that correlative study revealed, essentially in a nutshell, was that the salmonella assay had the best predictivity. Tin and Out looked at a number of different things. They looked at, I should have this paper in front of me, prediction, predictivity, sensitivity, and two other ways of assessing the relationship between the short-term test data and the cancer bioassay. And it was determined that although useful information could be obtained from any of these tests regarding how a chemical might produce an effect, in terms of the rodent cancer bioassay, the best predictivity was provided by a positive response in a bacterial mutagenicity assay, which was the salmonella test. Mm-hmm.
Which is also called the Ames test.
Correct, because Bruce Ames was the person who first developed this test. Okay. And so it's often referred to as the Ames test in his honor. And that was surprising to a lot of people. And it was counterintuitive to many people. Why would a bacterial mutagenicity test? Bacteria are very, very simple organisms genetically. One-celled organisms, they have a single chromosome that differs in many ways structurally from a mammalian chromosome. Mm-hmm. Why would that test be most predictive of a chemical's ability to induce cancer in a laboratory rodent, mice or rat? However, the data were there. The data clearly showed the best correlation between a positive response. You don't get a lot of help from a negative response in the salmonella test. But to this day, 2004, the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, all international testing efforts to describe the activities of a particular chemical include the salmonella test as a required part of the evaluation of a chemical's activity and potential risk to humans from exposure to that chemical. So it is still today a positive response in the salmonella assay is a clear red flag. It means this chemical is capable of inducing mutations in DNA, changes in DNA. Those changes may or may not result in increased risk to cancer, in laboratory rodents, which obviously the endpoint is not a laboratory rodent. We don't really care whether rats and mice get cancer from exposure to chemicals, but they're used, obviously, as tools to determine whether or not in certain circumstances, under certain protocols of exposure, a chemical can induce in a mammal lifetime exposure tumors. And then obviously we're extrapolating that risk to humans. The other assays did not show good correlation between either positive or negative results in trying to predict whether that chemical would cause a tumor in rodents. Okay, many of those assays were just overly sensitive. In the case of the Drosophila germ cell assays, they were very, very insensitive. Very, very few chemicals caused positive responses in those Drosophila assays. The ones that did, we would refer to pretty much as bad actors. Those were typically fairly potent chemicals. If they could actually induce an effect in one of those two Drosophila assays, they were probably going to cause an effect in something else and probably be fairly active in a rodent bioassay too. Consequently, they might carry an increased risk to humans exposed to it. But there were so few chemicals that were positive that it wasn't worth the effort of doing the test when you could get bacterial tests were so quick, relatively cheap, and with the good correlation between a positive response in Salmonella and a positive response in at least one sex, one species of rodents, it became the gold standard. Now, because bacteria are not mammals, people were both uneasy, and again, you come back to this, this is just not intuitive. Most regulatory agencies, I can't think of one that does not, also highly recommend an in vivo mammalian chromosomal damage assay of some sort. The most frequently used, because it's least expensive, requires fewer animals, and can be done the fastest and requires the least extensive training of individuals involved in evaluating the cells, is the rodent micronucleus assay. So currently the NTP maintains the capability of doing Salmonella testing and rodent micronucleus testing on any chemical of interest to the NTP, or members of a class of chemicals that the NTP determines they would, even if these chemicals are not going to go into the bioassay, they'd like to get an overall view of what's going on amongst a class of chemicals to be able to determine whether certain side groups or the position of a particular side group, how that might affect the genetic activity of a chemical. So we look at not only those chemicals that are of direct interest because we know they're going to wind up going through a bioassay, but classes of chemicals. So the NTP now does Salmonella testing. We do micronucleus testing. We have no longer the capability, or we have not retained contractual ability to test in the mouse lymphoma assay, which is an in vitro mammalian cell mutagenicity assay, nor do we any longer do Drosophila testing. NIEHS is a very active Drosophila genetic laboratory, but the questions that are asked by that laboratory are not genetic toxicology questions. That is Dr. Jim Mason. And he might be a fascinating person for you to talk with, because he was involved in the very beginning in the development of the Drosophila testing capabilities of the NTP. And he has now moved on into, I don't know exactly what he's doing, but I'm sure he's asking fascinating questions. Mm-hmm. He has quite a vital Drosophila testing laboratory mm-hmm. effort. And he also has been here for many, many years and can probably provide you a wonderful mm-hmm. background of Drosophila.
That would be very testing. Interesting.
That would be very, very interesting.
We were talking about the evolution of testing right. strategies.
Okay, so Salmonella has not changed very much over the years from the way it was probably 1989, 1992, around that time. Those were for every year, 2 years, 3 years, Errol Zeiger, who was the individual who developed the NTP Salmonella testing program, developed the protocols under which the NTP tests chemicals in the Salmonella assay. And the NTP now used for many, many years, multiple strains. The strains primarily used are TA100, TA1535, TA1537, TA97, TA98, TA102, and TA104. Genetically, these strains are different. Okay. Some of them are related. Some are TA98 and TA100 are basic strains. They carry two different types of mutations in the histidine operon, which is what the Salmonella strains are mutated in. It's various areas within the histidine operon. And what we're looking for in the Salmonella assay is taking a mutant strain, which is not... This would be a good point for us to stop and for me to run back and
great.
See... Slide. I was just showing the audience what I told you before, what the major efforts were in NTP genetic tox testing when the program got underway in full swing and when lots of database development was going on. Mm-hmm. So chemicals were being run through all these assays, and attempts were made to run the same chemical through mm-hmm. all the assays so you could compare the chemical and its performance amongst the different assays, as well as look at the overall results in an assay database and compare how well the assay correlated with the sorts of things that were seen in the rodent bioassay.
Okay. Sister chromatid exchange.
Genes, correct.
Chromosomal aberration.
Chinese hamster ovary
great.
Cell.
Great, thank you.
Unscheduled DNA synthesis.
Thank you.
These were the... See, what's the difference here? Past and present.
They're
past
the same.
And present.
No, they're different
no,
tests.
No, they're different tests.
In vitro, in vivo.
Thank you. Maybe I do need my notes going along with this. So here are the two Drosophila tests I mentioned to mm-hmm. you before. Sex-linked recessive lethal, that's looking at a gene mutation. Mm-hmm. Reciprocal translocation is looking at a chromosomal change. Okay. Mouse bone marrow chromosome aberration, sister chromatid exchange. It's the same type of endpoint, but looking in vivo in the entire animal, as opposed to in vitro. And obviously, there are differences in vitro versus in vivo. Number one is distribution of a chemical through mm-hmm. the organism. It has to get to the target tissue before mm-hmm. you can see a result. Number two, there's all sorts of metabolism that may mm-hmm. be going on. So one would expect to see differences in vivo compared to the in vitro mm-hmm. situation. The mouse and rat bone marrow micronucleus, mm-hmm. that was used and is used now as pretty much a substitute for chromosomal aberrations. And I'll explain that test in a little bit. Mouse peripheral blood micronucleus, same endpoint, just red blood cells are made in the bone marrow, mm-hmm. so we can look in the bone marrow or in the peripheral blood. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of advantages to using peripheral blood. It's a whole lot easier to obtain, and you don't have to sacrifice the animal mm-hmm. to obtain peripheral blood samples. You can serially sample the same animal through time, mm-hmm. or you can do other things with that same animal mm-hmm. and just need to take a blood sample at some point when you're mm-hmm. interested in looking at whether or not micronucleus frequencies in the red blood cells have been altered by chemical exposure. UDS is the unscheduled DNA synthesis in rat hepatocytes, where here we had an in vitro assay mm-hmm. where we take cultured rat hepatocytes, expose them to a chemical, and look to see whether or not we're having DNA synthesis occurring at times when we wouldn't expect it to occur in the cell cycle. That's indicative of the fact that damage was induced and now the cell needs to repair that okay. damage. So it's done either in vitro or it can be done in vivo, where the whole animal is treated and then at some time point thereafter hepatocytes are removed from the animal and DNA synthesis is observed at times when it shouldn't be occurring. Okay. Normally you have it as the cell begins to...
It just needs to be coaxed.
So the currently active, we've gone through this, the salmonella, the two different micronucleus assays, mm-hmm. the peripheral blood and the bone marrow assay. The types of genetic damage that are detected by the assays that are currently used. Are you going to have that are detected by the assays? And essentially, we only have two assays, micronucleus assay and the salmonella assay. The Ames test, I used Ames test instead mm-hmm. of salmon because it's shorter. I could mm-hmm. actually fit it in my column here. We look at single point mutations. Okay. And stop me if I'm saying things that you don't understand, because I don't
so
know
far
what
I'm
you're...
All right.
Okay. Or we can look at very small deletions, mm-hmm. not just a single base change, but maybe, you know, 10 bases mm-hmm. taken out, or two or three bases taken, a very short deletion. These are currently used assays, not just within the NTP program. HPRT mutation, that is looking at a particular gene mutation in cultured mammalian cells as opposed to bacterial cells. Again, that's looking at a single base change, and it's also looking at small deletions. The mouse lymphoma assay, you've heard me refer to that, that's a type of lymphoma cell derived from mice that is cultured in vitro. That can assess base changes, small deletions, as well as large deletions, chromosomal translocations, and mitotic recombination. We won't go into the details of that. It's not really necessary. Chromosomal aberrations, say in Chinese hamster rover cells in vitro, are going to look at large deletions or translocations. We're not looking at any single base changes there. Those are chromosomes, and we're looking for fairly close changes mm-hmm. in those chromosomes, structural changes. Micronuclei in bone marrow, they detect small deletions, large deletions, and translocations. So in other words, structural chromosomal changes, and they also will alert us to changes in chromosome number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a phenomenon we call, or a situation we call aneuploidy. Mm-hmm. In other words, typically you have 46 chromosomes in a human. If you have 45 or 47, that's an aneuploid situation, mm-hmm. okay? You've gained or lost a chromosome. The micronucleus test detects chromosome numerical changes. Then things that are involved, this has nothing to do with testing that we're doing now, but events that are involved, presumably, in the genesis of cancer, mm-hmm. okay? Those can be DNA base changes, they can be small deletions, large deletions, possibly mitotic recombination, and Suppressor gene activation can be brought about by any of these mm-hmm. base changes, small deletions, large deletions, translocations, whatever, simply by changing mm-hmm. The gene itself or the location of the gene, the proximity to other genes within the genome itself. So looking at all these things, pretty much the Ames test mm-hmm. and then the micronucleus test cover almost every one of these mm-hmm. possibilities. So even though we have currently restricted our program to micronucleus testing and Ames testing, mm-hmm. we are really not ignoring lots of different possible mm-hmm. mechanisms that might be involved in mm-hmm. carcinogenesis.
So may I ask you a question?
Certainly,
since you use
absolutely.
The word mechanism, can you? I hear a lot of talk about mechanism-based toxicology and bringing mechanisms into the NTP.
Right.
How does that intention relate to these testing programs?
That relates to these testing programs in two ways. One, indirectly, because we are looking at genetic changes by doing our two tests that we pretty much restrict ourselves to. By looking at the results of those two tests within the context of other information known about the chemical, whether that might be results of the bioassay or additional tests that the NTP is doing or knowledge that we acquire through other laboratories around mm-hmm. the world, we can infer mm-hmm. mechanism. The other, in other words, these results might be consistent with mm-hmm. a proposed mechanism, mm-hmm. okay? The other way is that the NTP genetic tox testing program has been authorized to, through approval of a concept review, to expand beyond doing these two assays and looking at certain mechanism-based endpoints. That effort is currently under development.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at ways to proceed.
Okay.
By right now, trying to learn as much as we can about some of the different kinds of assays, say assays that measure induction of apoptosis. Apoptosis is programmed cell death, and it's something that is involved in cancer because mm-hmm. it's believed that mechanisms that trigger apoptosis are overridden
mm-hmm.
by cancer cells, and they lose the ability to essentially commit suicide,
mm-hmm.
and therefore damaged cells continue to divide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're looking at how we might develop useful assays, looking at apoptosis, for
mm-hmm.
example. We're looking at whether or not there are different protocol designs for the current assays
mm-hmm.
that we do that may give us more mechanism-based information.
Okay.
This is an ongoing effort, and it's not a cop-out. We're trying to be very careful,
mm-hmm.
Having learned in the past that jumping on a bandwagon is not necessarily the way we want to go, because
mm-hmm.
things, new tests, new protocols, whatever, can appear to be extremely promising
mm-hmm.
and exciting at the outset, but as soon as a little bit more work has gone into an assay or
mm-hmm.
thought or looking at how that might fit into a broader picture, turns out that might be getting some interesting information,
mm-hmm.
but what to do with that information is not real
mm-hmm.
clear. So we would like to have a real careful approach to
mm-hmm.
how we proceed
mm-hmm.
With that. And I know that might not be very satisfying at this point, but we spent almost a year already looking carefully
mm-hmm.
at how we might use mechanism-based science as opposed to just testing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're exploring on paper a lot of different approaches,
mm-hmm.
but we've not yet put forth a proposal for testing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And when you have mechanism-based data from an assay, what does that enable you to do that having more phenomenological data does not enable?
Okay, well, once we know how a chemical induces an effect that we're measuring, we can determine a couple things. We can determine, is this the only mechanism by which this chemical operates? Or can it operate through different mechanisms under different situations? Okay, and then number two, when we have clearer ideas of how a chemical interacts with biological macromolecules, we can determine, hopefully, whether or not those mechanisms are active in an in vivo situation. In other words, if we see something occurring in vitro, is that relevant to what's occurring in vivo? In vivo, you're going to have more complex metabolism. Are you going to generate the same kind of active intermediates or endpoint metabolites, and will they be able to induce those same effects? So we hope to get more relevant information and help in ultimately in risk determination. I mean, that's the ultimate thing. Can we modify exposures in a certain way so that we're not going to generate those harmful intermediates or endpoint metabolites? I guess we'll have clearer ideas of what to do with that information when we get broader and more in-depth databases that are mechanism-based databases. But the hope is that the more you know about a chemical and how it operates in vivo, the better you're going to be able to determine what the ultimate risk is or how to mitigate that risk. What you can do to block that chemical action.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, the salmonella assay, I told you before, it's used everywhere. Industry, all international testing organizations, whatever. It has got the highest predictivity for rodent carcinogenicity. A positive response in this assay is the highest predictivity. A variety of different tester strains are used. They are all genetically different. Okay, slightly different. They all have mutations within the histidine operon, but slightly different mutations. So this way, using a number of genetically different strains allows us to provide more information, more opportunity for a particular chemical to induce a mutation, basically, because some chemicals may be better suited to looking at larger targets. We call them frameshift mutations. They're going to target the small deletion, small shifting of certain strands of DNA. Others are going to alkylate a particular base and cause a base change. Okay, so different mechanisms. And currently, the NTP is testing in TA100 and TA98, which are the basic strains from which these other strains are derived. Okay, we have the capability of looking at a number of different strains if we have a reason to do so. If we get a positive response in TA98 or TA100 under different testing situations, that's enough. Okay, basically our mission is to determine, can we induce mutations in salmonella? If the answer is yes, we'll move on. You know, and if another agency comes back and says, we want more information, we want to know a little bit more about how broad the capabilities might be of this chemical. You know, are there other strains that are sensitive? And then that may give us a little bit more information about how a chemical may operate. Although, Errol Zeiger, who's the person who developed our salmonella testing, in one of his recent papers, and I can get you the quote if you need it, stated emphatically in his review of the thousands of chemicals that have now gone through the salmonella assay, the most important endpoint is, does it induce a mutation, yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
In a strain,
mm-hmm.
under a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll get to activation, whether or not a chemical requires metabolic activation. Mm-hmm. There does not appear to be any relationship between strength of response
mm-hmm.
or broadness of the response across a number of strains
mm-hmm.
and carcinogenic potency,
mm-hmm.
if we can use that word on chemical. So if you get a yes or no answer, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot gained
mm-hmm.
by getting additional
mm-hmm.
answers, okay? There may be certain instances where gaining additional answers because we're doing a class of chemicals and we want to see how responses are going to differ with certain side groups added onto a parent molecule. But in terms of getting any more information, predicting predicting the carcinogenicity of a chemical in the rodent bioassay, there's no more to be gained.
Okay.
So at this point, we're testing TA100, TA98, with and without what we refer to as metabolic activation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is because when you take a chemical and you put it in a person,
mm-hmm.
the liver metabolizes right. that chemical. Bacteria have no liver.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, what we do is we get liver enzyme extracts mm-hmm. from rodents that typically have been what we call induced. In other words, they are pre-treated with a chemical that heightens mm-hmm. the liver enzyme profile in that rodent
mm-hmm.
so that we're going to really have the liver revved up. Lots of metabolizing enzymes are going to be produced so that when we go in and extract those enzymes, we've got quite a pile.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take that. It's well-defined protocol. In fact, you just buy commercial S9
mm-hmm.
is what it's called, and add it to your salmonella strains in various amounts, and then you test your chemical. So you test it with and without activation. That lets you know whether or not to anticipate that a chemical metabolite or an intermediate is actually inducing the effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because if you get a response without liver S9, then it's presumed, since the bacteria really doesn't metabolize this the way mammals do, that the chemical is a direct acting mutagen.
Okay.
If you need to add S9 liver enzymes to the salmonella strains before you detect mutagenicity, then metabolism of that chemical to an active intermediate or an end metabolite is necessary to provide produce the mutagenic response. This is the slide that just describes S9,
okay.
What it is, where you get it from. There are P450 enzymes in the liver. Most people haven't heard that term anymore. This is just a schematic actually showing how you do this very simple assay. Essentially, you mix your bacteria, your media, your test chemical with or without the S9, depending upon if you're using activation or not. Mix it all together. And remember, I told you we're looking at mutations within the histidine operon. So the bacteria normally can manufacture their own histidine.
Mm-hmm.
These are mutant bacteria that we're testing in the salmonella
mm-hmm.
assay. They have got a mutation somewhere in that histidine operon that prevents them from manufacturing their own histidine.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be given histidine in their growth medium.
Mm-hmm.
So we take these bacteria, we expose them to a chemical, we put them, we grow them out on a histidine deficient plate.
Mm-hmm.
So that if we have no mutations occurring,
mm-hmm.
we're going to get only a certain number of mutant colonies growing on that plate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of histidine in here, trace amounts of histidine
mm-hmm.
in this agron, which these bacteria are grown, to allow them to undergo a couple cell divisions, because you
mm-hmm.
have to, what's called, fix a mutation.
Mm-hmm.
The DNA has to divide, replicate, in order for that mutation to be fixed, okay? And then you can get mutant colonies to grow. So you give a little bit of histidine to allow a little bit of growth to occur before it runs out of histidine, and nothing's going to happen then unless you've got a mutant cell growing up into a colony. So you've got a certain number of background. If your chemical is a mutagen, and this is hard to see on this printout.
No, but I can see the difference.
There's an increase in in the number of mutant colonies. More chemical, higher dose.
Right.
Look at that.
Right.
Okay, this is such an easy, straightforward test.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get colony growth, you've got a mutagen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and typically we look for a dose response. We test at least 5 doses of chemical, maybe more, and you should see a clear dose response with increasing number of mutant colonies if we've induced a mutation.
That's very clear.
In that strain. Very easy, very straightforward. We do automated plate counting, whatever. So this is just, it's such a quick and easy assay to perform. It's just unbelievable that such a quick and easy assay correlates so well with what, but we're looking at a genetic event, and cancer's a genetic disease. Not all mutagens are carcinogens. Not all carcinogens are mutagens. There are other mechanisms by which you get cancer, but there's a pretty good correlation between mutagens and carcinogens.
And the other mechanisms are promotion, right? Non-genotoxic.
Right, right.
Effects.
Like you've got an initial hit, something occurred, and then you've got a chemical which is going to stimulate cell growth, for example. So if you've got a mutant colony and it's been, or a mutant cell, whatever, and all of a sudden you do something to that tissue or that group of cells to really promote their turnover, more than likely you're going to promote the growth of cancer. Because the faster a cell turns over continually, the greater the chances of an error occurring, or the less time there is to get that error repaired. And what you have is you've got like cell signaling going on within the cell saying, wait a minute, we've got a mistake here. Stop, everybody, hold. We need to repair this. DNA repair, okay? But then you've got this other stimulus saying, divide, 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 divide. And these get out of whack. And so the request to divide overrides the request to halt all operations and fix what's gone wrong. And that is a mechanism by which you can generate cancer.
Let me ask you more about that, because one of the things that I've been studying down here is the development of transgenic mouse models as bioassays.
Okay.
Will that appear in this at any point?
That is actually one of the organisms that we do the micronucleus test on.
Okay.
That's pretty much our involvement. It's just that they are doing a number of these tests, and we are routinely doing peripheral blood micronuclei on these animals, frequently at various stages during the exposure. Like they may expose those animals, 26 to 39 weeks, something like that. So we may actually have micronucleus data at 4 weeks, at 13 weeks, at 24 weeks, at 39 weeks, which is very interesting because we can see what is happening to that micronucleus frequency through time, and are there any differences. And also, I think the validation effort with those transgenic strains is using either simultaneously or used previously that chemical in the B63F1 mice that are standardly used in the bioassay. So you get comparative data between the transgenic and the traditional B63F1 mouse. And so we have got micronucleus data for some of those chemicals in both situations. And so we have comparative data there. There hasn't been any formal analysis yet of that data. I'm sure there will be when the testing effort is thoroughly analyzed and compared to the bioassay. But that is our involvement. We're not in any way, shape, or form directing that testing or inputting into study design or anything like that. But we are getting blood samples from mm-hmm. those animals and routinely doing microbial mm-hmm. studies on them.
And my understanding is that at least one of those animals, the TGA sea mouse, was developed in part because there was a perception that the NTP needed a promoter assay. Is that...
You would really have to talk to the folks that are involved more okay. intimately in those transgenic assays.
Okay. I guess to ask the question differently, has it been a problem or has it been a challenge for the NTP that a good promoter assay hasn't been available?
Promotion is obviously a mechanism through which cancer is generated. I can't really answer that question because I'm just not involved in the bioassay
okay.
aspect of that, and it would be better to get a historical perspective from somebody who has been
okay.
Involved in that for a long period of time. Probably also because of the fact that up until a year ago, I was either a contractor or on an interagency agreement. Mm-hmm. There were some restrictions on my involvement mm-hmm. in the NTP because I needed to stay within the guidelines or the directives mm-hmm. of my employment agreement. Mm-hmm. And so I focused more on just the genetic
Great.
Toxicology as
okay.
opposed to the broader NTP efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm an NTP or NIEHS employee, I'm really involved in a number of things
mm-hmm.
that I can see gain quite an appreciation for
mm-hmm.
all the different efforts that are going on. But since I don't have that historical background mm-hmm. in that, I could probably be mislead you
okay.
or just because
That's
of the
fine.
Fact that I've got a lot of holes
mm-hmm.
in my background there. Right. So you need to talk to the folks that are experts in
All
it.
Right.
Have you talked to Jeff French or do you have
I
him
have.
On?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, because Jeff French's mind, name comes to mind when
uh-huh.
you say TGAC.
Right.
Okay. There are modifications in terms of protocols so that we can test gaseous, in the salmonella assay, so that we can test gaseous chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Volatile chemicals, things like that. The pre-incubation modification step is very simple. All it does is allow us to hold the mix for 20 minutes or so
mm-hmm.
and allow greater exposure
mm-hmm.
potential of the chemical in the cells before we pour it onto
okay.
the plate. Okay, so these are just very basic protocol modifications. This is the just a picture for the audience to show them how we
mm-hmm.
stack plates in a desiccator and then we feed in either air through a tube that's got the chemical that's a vapor in it
mm-hmm.
or we put a volatile chemical below and allow it to diffuse through the desiccator, but we trap the chemical in so that we get good exposure of the plates. We evaluate the data and we determine whether or not a chemical is a mutagen. If we see a reproducible dose-related increase, I showed you those plates, and
sure.
clearly you can see dose-related increases. We've got a mutagen. We may characterize some chemicals as weak mutagens if we have a dose-related increase, but the magnitude of that increase is less than twice the background number of colonies. We may say, yeah, this is clearly mutagenic, but there is a difference. Okay, so basically we find out whether or not a chemical is a mutagen or a non-mutagen. And a positive response in any strain, remember mm-hmm. I said we can use multiple strains, under any activation condition is sufficient for an mm-hmm. overall positive call. So we don't require like two different strains and with and without S9. Then there's the rodent bone marrow micronucleus test, okay? That's the one that I was telling you, that rodent bone marrow or peripheral blood are our two micronucleus test capabilities. The rodent bone marrow micronucleus test detects induced chromosomal damage in erythrocytes, red blood cells, okay? We can detect either a change in chromosome number or structural damage. Do you know what a micronucleus is?
No.
No. Okay. So
I actually was just reading that.
All right. So when a micronucleus, when a cell undergoes some sort of damage, either a spindle fiber is disrupted, its centromere in a chromosome is structurally altered or something, so it doesn't move correctly during cell division, or if a piece is broken off or whatever, when the cell divides and forms two daughter cells, that whole chromosome or that little hunk of genetic material that has broken free is oftentimes lost. It's not properly incorporated because it hasn't moved to one or the two poles when the cell divides. And what happens is when the cell goes back into interphase, then it forms a nuclear membrane around its genetic material. That little piece or whole chromosome that's left forms the same little thing. So it's literally a micronucleus sitting inside the cell. It's easily detectable.
Great.
And the reason that the NTP uses erythrocytes is because, and see this on the slide, it's fluorescent staining and whatnot, so you can see how easily it is to detect it, but this is exactly what happens, is you've got a piece or a whole chromosome, in this case it's a piece, that's broken off, and here's your two daughter cells, you'll form a cell membrane in between there, but there sits your little micronucleus, and actually this picture is a little misleading because this micronucleus will look exactly like that. The staining characteristics, the texture of it, etc., is exactly the same. It's just much smaller. So it's very easy to see. You go under a light microscope, these fluorescent stains, and there sits your little micronucleus. There sits one, and actually it looks like there's another one right there. And so it's so quick. You can scan literally thousands of cells. And in the case of an erythrocyte, let's see if it... No, I don't have a picture. These are just additional pictures, and we'll just, without having them on a overhead, they're harder to see. But the erythrocyte is kind of unique, in that it doesn't contain a nucleus. So it did at the start, the stem cells do, but as the erythrocyte matures, the last thing it does before it becomes a full-blown erythrocyte is it pushes out its nucleus. Erythrocytes are terminal cells that cannot divide any further. So if you're scanning a whole bunch of erythrocytes, say these are erythrocytes here, they will have nothing that fluoresces. We use a DNA-specific stain. But if the thing about micronuclei in erythrocytes is that if, prior to that last cell division, a micronucleus has been formed due to structural or numerical problem, the micronucleus apparently is too small for the cell to sense its presence. So it is not pushed out of the cell with the main nucleus. It stays behind. So erythrocytes are extremely amenable to scoring micronuclei. You can score 1,000 erythrocytes and two of them are going to have micronuclei. And they'll just stand out so easily. And so that's why we score erythrocytes in the bone marrow of mice and rats. We can only score erythrocytes in the peripheral blood of mice. The reason is when a damaged erythrocyte moves out into the bloodstream, the spleen, within just a couple hours, as the cell, as the blood circulates, it goes through the spleen too. It's on one of its many trips, and the spleen can detect whether or not there's damage to a blood cell, and it will remove that blood cell from circulation. So in rats, they have very, very efficient spleens, as do humans, and they can instantly pick up on a damaged erythrocyte. They'll remove it. So by the time we go to look in the peripheral blood for micronucleated erythrocytes, they're not going to be there.
That's interesting.
But mice have very, very inefficient spleens. And so the damage that occurs in the bone marrow moves out into the blood and is not removed. So we can do peripheral blood on mice, which is really, really nice. These are just more slides that show how the difference between an angiogen and a clastogen form the damage. Why are we interested in a chemical's ability to do some micronuclei? Okay, so the chromosome will change, and most cancers are characterized actually, by chromosomal changes that occur at some point along the way. Chromosomal changes are characteristic of almost all tumors. Aneuploidy or chromosomal changes in germ cells, we're not talking about cancer at a point now, we're talking about germ cells, are major causes of birth defects. And spontaneous abortions, other sorts of adverse reproductive outcomes. So actually looking for chromosomal damage as a result of exposure to a chemical gives us information not only about whether or not that chemical might have some carcinogenic potential, but it also alerts us to the fact that it's possible if that chemical gets to the germ cells, that there may be some reproductive consequences to exposure to that chemical also. So it's very relevant to know whether or not a chemical can induce chromosomal damage in vivo. So this is just an overview of the standard protocol for doing a micronucleus test. This is the bone marrow test. You treat your animal. We typically treat 3 different days because if we're somehow interfering with the dynamics of erythrocyte production by administering a chemical once, we would probably have to, I'm not going to get it, but let me just double check with that. We would have to use more animals because we would have to harvest the bone marrow at different times after. So if we just take our usual number of animals and treat them multiple times, then just harvest once, we will have pretty much taken into account any kind of changes in erythropoiesis that might have been induced by the chemical or requirements for metabolism of the chemical that might take a while to generate the active intermediate or metabolite. So this is, again, just an overview. We treat the animal, then we remove the bone marrow, we look for micronuclei.
Okay.
Very easy. And again, this looks really pretty in color. The peripheral blood micronucleus test, we treat the animals for a longer period of time. We routinely incorporate that test in our 13-week toxicity studies. Those are studies that precede the bioassay, usually dose-setting studies or whatever. So routinely, at the end of those 13-week studies, we get peripheral blood samples, we make slides, and they're sent to the lab and scored for micronuclei. That way, on the same animal where maybe some immunotox stuff is done or some neurotox stuff is done or whatever other sorts of toxicology endpoints are assayed in those animals, we can, in the same animals, also get micronucleus information, which allows us then maybe to better correlate everything because it's exactly the same animals on a separate test being done. Same thing. The animals are treated, get a blood sample, make a slide, stain it, look for micronuclei. Great. Very, very simple. The evaluation, we look for both a trend, in other words, some sort of an increase over doses because there's multiple doses always used. And we also look at each dose level and we compare it back to the control. We use fairly stringent statistics to determine whether or not a chemical is positive. And if we get either or both a positive trend, actually, and at least one of the doses significantly different, we say, okay, this chemical is capable of inducing micronuclei. The acute tests are always repeated. These longer-term peripheral blood tests are not because they're piggybacked on to some other test, and those tests are not repeated. So usually we'll have male and female. We feel a little bit better if we see the same response in males and females. But if clearly one sex responded differently than the other, we call the chemical positive, say, in females, negative in males. In this particular talk, I looked at different sorts of results comparing Salmonella, micronucleus, and then the carcinogenicity. Are all of these discordant? These were all discordancies, because somebody had asked a question at once, what do you know, if you're positive in Salmonella, are you automatically positive in micronucleus, and how does that relate to carcinogenicity? Here are example three NTP chemicals. They were all very nicely positive in Salmonella. They were all very nicely negative in the micronucleus test, and they were flaming carcinogens. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's okay. These are strong gene mutagens. Mm-hmm. Causing a gene mutation is definitely a way that you can get cancer.
Okay,
so there's a discordancy among the three tests, but nothing scientifically mm-hmm. odd mm-hmm. about that group of chemicals and those results. We can have the converse. Aniline benzene is a very good carcinogen. That's a human carcinogen, okay? Phenolphthalein was an ingredient that was in X-lax.
Right,
exactly. Aniline is a dye, mm-hmm. or the basis of a lot of different dyes. These are all real good carcinogens. Mm-hmm. There's a dispute as to whether phenolphthalein is a human carcinogen, mm-hmm. but it was clearly an animal carcinogen. None of these are positive in the Salmonella test. Mm-hmm. They don't cause gene mutations, mm-hmm. okay? But they're all positive in the micronucleus assay. Benzene is just a flamer, mm-hmm. And phenolphthalein is a very good inducer of micronuclei, particularly in the longer-term peripheral blood studies.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about phenolphthalein. I interviewed June about phenolphthalein,
uh-huh.
and she used the transgenic mice, right?
She used
P53 mice
right.
to show that phenolphthalein induces mutations in the P53 gene.
It does, and it also is very strong micronucleus response in those P53 mm-hmm. mice also.
Why would something cause mutations in P53 that wouldn't show up in Salmonella?
The P53, first of all, benzene, as an example, requires an extensive metabolism before you get to the mm-hmm. chemical. I can't remember now, phenolphthalein, what the metabolic profile of that thing is. But
that would be the answer. That requires
would be the answer,
activation.
Is some kind of, and plus also you realize that those animals have got one hit already. So
right.
they're damaged in terms of DNA repair.
Mm-hmm.
So if something is breaking DNA,
mm-hmm.
they've already got one hit. If breaks occur in areas that might affect the P53 gene,
mm-hmm.
you could also suppose that you might have something going on
okay.
there. But and P53 is that gene that has to do with DNA repair.
Right.
Okay, so I think basically it's metabolism,
okay.
because I know the same thing's going on with the aniline
right.
too. So,
thank you.
And in fact, I said phenolphthalein is a very good inducer of micronuclei in the longer-term peripheral blood site. In a 13-week study with the B6C3F1 mice, that thing came out flaming positive,
mm-hmm.
and there was no other indication at that point that anything was going on. So they made the decision to go into the bioassay
mm-hmm.
because there was a positive micronucleus response. One thing I didn't say about the peripheral blood micronucleus test, a preliminary analysis of that of those tests, which was published in, I can give you that actually, showed that although very few chemicals are positive in the peripheral blood micronucleus study in the NTP thing, those that are all carcinogens.
Mm. Okay.
So the fact that okay. phenolphthalein came up positive, strongly positive, male and female mice in the 13-week
mm-hmm.
studies was a real eyebrow raiser.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went ahead and they did the bioassay, and lo and behold, it was a carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
And then when June did some additional longer-term studies in the P53 mice, we also did micronuclei in those mice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was just amazing, the mm-hmm. micronucleus levels. But the acute bone marrow studies we did with phenolphthalein were a real problem,
mm-hmm.
not trying to get micronuclei. There was something going on with metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
We did a whole series of tests with phenolphthalein,
mm-hmm.
administering it in food pellets, fasting the animals beforehand. It seemed that you needed to get long-term, low-dose
mm-hmm.
exposure. There's something going on metabolically
mm-hmm.
with that. So that's why AIM was negative.
Okay.
I should, I hate to do this, but in the next 5 or 10 minutes, I need to go to the other campus and do an interview over there.
Right. So okay. Well, here are your notes. They've printed off too, so you can
fantastic.
You've got the slides on here too, I think. Yeah, so you can match those all up. But again, these are just, you know, and they're here, you've got non-genotoxins inducing mm-hmm. cancer. Here you've got genotoxins. Look, ascorbic acid, vitamin C.
Right.
No cancer.
Right.
So you can get every possible combination,
mm-hmm.
okay? But there are reasons
mm-hmm.
for this. We're not just going, wow, are we surprised? There,
mm-hmm.
hopefully we have some understanding of what's
mm-hmm.
going on with these chemicals too. There are new assays being considered by the program. In fact, we are currently doing validation assays now, looking at what we call kinetochore staining. That's using a micronucleus test where we're staining the micronucleus with a second fluorochrome
mm-hmm.
to see whether or not there's a centromere in that micronucleus.
Mm-hmm.
If there is, that's strongly correlated with an entire chromosome being in
okay.
there. Okay, so it gives us an idea of how that micronucleus got there. Is
mm-hmm.
it an aneuploidy event? Is it chromosome damage?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are doing this. We are currently doing this also.
Okay.
Flow cytometric analysis of mouse or rat. This is the big breakthrough
mm-hmm.
because we can label the erythrocytes with a marker for a protein that only appears on brand new erythrocytes right fresh out of the bone marrow.
Mm-hmm.
We can grab those within 1 to 2 hours before the spleen's gotten to
mm-hmm.
them in the rat and evaluate them from micronuclei.
Okay.
That gives us the possibility of also looking at rats in the 13-week studies.
Mm-hmm.
We've never been able to do that
mm-hmm.
before. So we're doing these currently right now, big validation studies for both of these. We're also doing COMET assays,
mm-hmm.
which looks for DNA damage in a single cell. All sorts of DNA damage,
mm-hmm.
okay, kind of indiscriminate DNA damage
mm-hmm.
as an adjunct to some of these other endpoints that we're looking at. But we can do this in the same animals that we're doing
mm-hmm.
micronucleus testing and in a variety of tissues, which
mm-hmm.
is nice.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at liver, we can look at kidney, we can look at stomach, we
mm-hmm.
can look at brain. These are just more slides talking about the types of DNA damage detected in the COMET assay.
Okay.
A very, very basic outline of what's done in the COMET assay.
Okay.
Again, we can do the same, use the same animals that we use for a micronucleus test. It's just at the end,
mm-hmm.
things are done differently with those samples than the blood. Oh, we can also do COMET in the blood, too.
Mm-hmm.
This is how it gets its name. We're looking at something that actually looks like a COMET.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a cell. It's moving through, it's being electrophoresed
mm-hmm.
through a gel, and the DNA that's damaged is going to be moving at different rates than non-ends. It looks like a comet. There's a computer program that visualizes this and measures this as well as volume,
mm-hmm.
and from that is computed degree of DNA damage.
Mm-hmm.
Participants, ILSs, these have changed. We have a new contract now.
mm-hmm.
And Bill and I are now project officers.
Mm-hmm.
BioReliance is finishing up its salmonella testing for us. SRI is no longer a contract, not because they're not fantastic. Christine Mortlemans is one of the pioneers in salmonella
mm-hmm.
testing. SciTech is doing our kinetochore work for us,
mm-hmm.
and they're currently doing our salmonella testing for us. ILS is our overall contractor. They're here mm-hmm. in the park.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just additional
That's
things
great.
That went back to the beginning.
That's so helpful. Thank you so much. You really, I wish you were a biology professor. They're an incredible teacher.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I should have actually refreshed my memory on this last night. We have got different versions of this, I think.
Is there anything?
I just put all this together for you. You can sort through it because I know you have to run. I think we've got two versions of the
okay.
of the actual program, and here's the one with
that's
the notes,
great.
And that's probably the one you're going to use. But we'll go like this.
Is there anything I should have asked you that we should have talked about that?
If you're talking about the history
yet?
Of the program, I don't think so. The one thing that I need to provide you, if you don't already have them, are the follow-up studies that were done to the 87 tenant paper.
I don't have them.
Okay, because I'm believing that there were two. There may have only been one, but I think there were two follow-ups mm-hmm. where they took additional chemicals that came off, like, say, in another 2 years from mm-hmm. the testing program, and they did the same sort of analysis mm-hmm. comparing to the bioassay, and it confirmed and refined mm-hmm. The predictivity. So you might want to have those just for completion.
Okay. I can ask Ray also if that would be easier.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
I will be back here in July to do a presentation with Ray where I'll do kind of, the history piece, and then he'll talk about state-of-the-art testing.
Yeah, moved on into the microarray work.
Right.
And, all that,
and actually, just, I mean, in a couple of minutes, is there a way in which these tests and these protocols have led to toxicogenomics and microarray? Are they related? And Mike and I were talking yesterday about the difference between looking at gene damage and looking at gene expression.
Right, right. I don't know that Ray would best be able to explain how microarray arose. But as technology developed, we gained very, very rapidly an ability to go from taking days or hours to, say, sequence or to, you know, analyze gene activity or something mm-hmm. to all of a sudden the capability of looking at 1,000 genes and seeing which ones got turned on mm-hmm. and which ones got turned off. And with the frustration of not having been able to devise a short-term test, mm-hmm. and I think they probably won't ever be able to. It's just my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. I think cancer is a very complex mm-hmm. disease, and every cancer is a different disease.
Right.
It really is. So I think it's too simplistic to say that surely there must be some quick test tube thing that can mm-hmm. predict. But so this was frustrating. Mm-hmm. that they couldn't come up with some way of at least narrowing down mm-hmm. the candidate chemicals, although Salmonella does that very well mm-hmm. by saying if you have positive Salmonella, that probably this is a carcinogen mm-hmm. and let's not even deal with this chemical further. Mm-hmm. You know, let's look at the ones that weren't positive mm-hmm. Salmonella. I think this really spurred, as soon as somebody realized that there was a possibility of assaying a lot of genes for activity all at one time, all of a sudden this basic desire to find some way of quickly gaining a profile of a chemical's activity in an organism blossomed back up again. Mm-hmm. And the thought was, oh my goodness, here's a way of doing this. Mm-hmm. There are probably two camps, at least right now. One that thinks microarray is the greatest thing since sliced bread and is going to be the answer to everything. Because look, here we've got thousands and thousands and thousands of genes turning on and turning off. There's the other camp that says, uh-huh, you do, and you're generating tons of data and nobody has a clue what mm-hmm. to do with any of that data.
Mm-hmm.
And they are entering it into databases. But nobody yet has figured out what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of confidence that somebody will, mm-hmm. or somebodies will, mm-hmm. figure out what to do with all this data and what it means. But right now, they're just looking at patterns.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when this chemical in this tissue or this organism or under these circumstances enters into the picture?
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's back to trying to find a tool that's going to give us an answer without having to go through the black box of the bioassay. Mm-hmm. Organism, chemical in, tumors out. Mm-hmm. What happens in between, and what does this have to do with people?
Mm-hmm.
It's a leap from the bacteria to the mouse and the rat, and it's at least as big a leap mm-hmm. to a human, real life human exposure mm-hmm. scenario. Mm-hmm. People are usually not exposed to high dose
right.
lifetime exposures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's either an acute once in a while,
right.
or it's low dose continual, mm-hmm. or maybe for 10 years, mm-hmm. or during a certain period
right.
of
occupation.
Development,
right.
or right 7 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
The exposure scenarios in humans are typically